The guilt is ours, he thought. If we who were the movers, providers, the benefactors of mankind, were willing to let the brand of evil be stamped upon us and silently to bear punishment for our virtues, what sort of good did we expect to triumph in the world? He looked at the people around him. They had cheered him today. They had cheered him by the side of the track of the John Galt line. But tomorrow they would clamor for a new directive from Wesley Mooch and a free housing project from Orrin Boyle, while Boyle's girders collapsed upon their heads. They would do it because they would be told to forget as a sin that which had made them cheer Hank Reardon. Why were they ready to renounce their highest moments as a sin? Why were they willing to betray the best within them? What made them believe that this earth was a realm of evil where despair was their natural fate? He could not name the reason, but he knew that it had to be named. He felt it as a huge question mark within the courtroom, which it was now his duty to answer. This was the real sentence imposed upon him, he thought, to discover what idea, what simple idea available to the simplest man, had made mankind accept the doctrines that led it to self-destruction. Hank, I'll never think that it's hopeless, not ever again, said Dagny that evening after the trial. I'll never be tempted to quit. You've proved that the right always works and always wins. She stopped, then added, provided one knows what is the right. Lillian said to him at dinner next day, so you've won, have you? Her voice was noncommittal. She said nothing else. She was watching him as if studying a riddle. The wet nurse asked him at the mills, Mr. Reardon, what's a moral premise? What you're going to have a lot of trouble with. The boy frowned, then shrugged and said, laughing, God, that was a wonderful show. What a beating you gave them, Mr. Reardon. I sat by the radio and howled. How do you know it was a beating? Well, it was, wasn't it? Are you sure of it? Sure, I'm sure. The thing that makes you sure is a moral premise. The newspapers were silent. After the exaggerated attention they had given to the case, they acted as if the trial were not worthy of notice. They printed brief accounts on unlikely pages, worded in such generalities that no reader could discover any hint of a controversial issue. The businessmen he met seemed to wish to evade the subject of his trial. Some made no comment at all, but turned away, their faces showing a peculiar resentment under the effort to appear noncommittal, as if they feared that the mere act of looking at him would be interpreted as taking a stand. Others ventured to comment, In my opinion, Mr. Reardon, it was extremely unwise of you. It seems to me that this is hardly the time to make enemies. We can't afford to arouse resentment. Whose resentment? He asked. I don't think the government will like it. You saw the consequences of that. Well, I don't know. The public won't take it. There's bound to be a lot of indignation. You saw how the public took it. Well, I don't know. We've been trying hard not to give any grounds for all those accusations about selfish greed, and you've given ammunition to the enemy. Would you rather agree with the enemy that you have no right to your profits and your property? Oh, no, no, certainly not. But why go to extremes? There's always a middle ground.
A middle ground? Between you and your murderers?
Now, why use such words?
What I said at the trial. Was it true or not?
It's going to be misquoted and misunderstood.
Was it true or not?
The public is too dumb to grapple with such issues.
Was it true or not?
It's no time to boast about being rich when the populace is starving. It's just goading them on to seize everything.
But telling them that you have no right to your wealth while they have is what's going to restrain them?
Well, I don't know.
I don't like the things you said at your trial, said another man. In my opinion, I don't agree with you at all. Personally, I'm proud to believe that I am working for the public good, not just for my own profit. I like to think that I have some goal higher than just earning my 3 meals a day in my Hammond limousine.
And I don't like that idea about no directives and no controls, said another. I grant you the running hog wild and overdoing it, but no controls at all? I don't go along with that. I think some controls are necessary, the ones which are for the public good.
I am sorry, gentlemen, said Reardon, that I will be obliged to save your goddamn necks along with mine. A group of businessmen headed by Mr. Moen did not issue any statements about the trial, but a week later they announced, with an inordinate amount of publicity, that they were endowing the construction of a playground for the children of the unemployed. Bertram Scudder did not mention the trial in his column, but 10 days later he wrote, among items of miscellaneous gossip, "Some idea of the public value of Mr. Hank Reardon may be gathered from the fact that of all social groups, he seems to be the most unpopular with his own fellow businessmen. His old-fashioned brand of ruthlessness seems to be too much even for those predatory barons of profit." On an evening in December, when the street beyond his window was like a congested throat, coughing with the horns of pre-Christmas traffic, Reardon sat in his room at the Wayne Falkland Hotel, fighting an enemy more dangerous than weariness or fear, revulsion against the thought of having to deal with human beings. He sat unwilling to venture into the streets of the city, unwilling to move, as if he were chained to his chair and to this room. He had tried for hours to ignore an emotion that felt like the pull of homesickness, his awareness that the only man whom he longed to see was here in this hotel, just a few floors above him. He had caught himself in the past few weeks wasting time in the lobby whenever he entered the hotel or left it, loitering unnecessarily at the mail counter or the newsstand, watching the hurried currents of people, hoping to see Francisco D'Anconia among them. He had caught himself eating solitary dinners in the restaurant of the Wayne Falkland, with his eyes on the curtains of the entrance doorway. Now he caught himself sitting in his room, thinking that the distance was only a few floors. He rose to his feet with a chuckle of amused indignation. He was acting, he thought, like a woman who waits for a telephone call and fights against the temptation to end the torture by making the first move. There was no reason, he thought, why he could not go to Francisco D'Anconia if that was what he wanted. Yet when he told himself that he would, he felt some dangerous element of surrender in the intensity of his own relief. He made a step toward the phone to call Francisco's suite, but stopped. It was not what he wanted. What he wanted was simply to walk in unannounced, as Francisco had walked into his office. It was this that seemed to state some unstated right between them. On his way to the elevator, he thought, he won't be in, or if he is, you'll probably find him entertaining some floozy which will serve you right. But the thought seemed unreal. He could not make it apply to the man he had seen at the mouth of the furnace. He stood confidently in the elevator, looking up. He walked confidently down the hall, feeling his bitterness relax into gaiety. He knocked at the door. Francisco's voice snapped, "Come in." It had a brusque, absent-minded sound. Reardon opened the door and stopped on the threshold. One of the hotel's costliest satin-shaded lamps stood in the middle of the floor, throwing a circle of light on wide sheets of drafting paper. Francisco D'Anconia, in shirt sleeves, a strand of hair hanging down over his face, lay stretched on the floor on his stomach, propped up by his elbows, biting the end of a pencil in concentration upon some point of the intricate tracing before him. He did not look up. He seemed to have forgotten the knock. Reardon tried to distinguish the drawing. It looked like the section of a smelter. He stood watching in startled wonder. Had he had the power to bring into reality his own image of Francisco D'Anconia? This was the picture he would have seen, the figure of a purposeful young worker, intent upon a difficult task. In a moment, Francisco raised his head. In the next instant, he flung his body upward to a kneeling posture, looking at Reardon with a smile of incredulous pleasure. In the next, he seized the drawings and threw them aside too hastily, face down.
"What did I interrupt?" asked Reardon.
"Nothing much. Come in."
He was grinning happily.
Reardon felt suddenly certain that Francisco had waited too, had waited for this as for a victory which he had not quite hoped to achieve.
"What were you doing?" asked Reardon.
"Just amusing myself.
Let me see it."
"No."
He rose and kicked the drawings aside. Reardon noted that if he had resented as impertinence Francisco's manner of proprietorship in his office, he himself was now guilty of the same attitude, because he offered no explanation for his visit, but crossed the room and sat down in an armchair, casually, as if he were at home.